Thank you, John. Take your Bibles and let us turn to Ezekiel chapter 1. And I will be reading Ezekiel 1:1 through 3:15. And our focus is going to be on 1:28 to 3:15, but it's kind of one big unit, and so we really do need to work with the whole thing. So Ezekiel, beginning at chapter 1 and verse 1. In the 30th year, in the fourth month, on the fifth day, while I was among the exiles by the Kibar River, the heavens were opened, and I saw visions of God. On the fifth of the month, it was the fifth year of the exile of King Jehoiakim, the word of the Lord came to Ezekiel the priest, the son of Buzi, by the Kibar River in the land of the Babylonians. There the hand of the Lord was upon him. I looked, and I saw a windstorm coming out of the north, an immense cloud with flashing lightning and surrounded by brilliant light. The center of the fire looked like glowing metal, and in the fire was what looked like four living creatures. In appearance, their form was that of a man, but each of them had four faces and four wings. Their legs were straight, their feet were like those of a calf and gleamed like burnished bronze. Under their wings, on their four sides, they had the hands of a man. All four of them had faces and wings, and their wings touched one another. Each one went straight ahead. They did not turn as they moved. Their faces looked like this. Each of the four had the face of a man, and on the right side, each had the face of a lion, and on the left, the face of an ox. Each also had the face of an eagle. Such were their faces. Their wings were spread out upward. Each had two wings, one touching the wing of another creature on either side, and two wings covering its body. Each one went straight ahead. Wherever the spirit would go, they would go without turning as they went. The appearance of the living creatures was like burning coals of fire, or like torches. Fire moved back and forth among the creatures. It was bright, and lightning flashed out of it. The creatures sped back and forth like flashes of lightning. As I looked at the living creatures, I saw a wheel on the ground beside each creature with its four faces. This was the appearance and structure of the wheels. They sparkled like chrysolite, and all four looked alike. Each appeared to be made like a wheel intersecting a wheel. As they moved, they would go in any one of the four directions the creatures faced. The wheels did not turn about as the creatures went. Their rims were high and awesome, and all four rims were full of eyes all around. When the living creatures moved, the wheels beside them moved. And when the living creatures rose from the ground, the wheels also rose. Wherever the spirit would go, they would go, and the wheels would rise along with them, because the spirit of the living creatures was in the wheels. When the creatures moved, they also moved. When the creatures stood still, they also stood still. And when the creatures rose from the ground, the wheels rose along with them, because the spirit of the living creatures was in the wheels. Spread out above the heads of the living creatures was what looked like an expanse, sparkling like ice and awesome. Under the expanse, their wings were stretched out, one toward the other, and each had two wings covering its body. When the creatures moved, I heard the sound of their wings like the roar of rushing waters, like the voice of the Almighty, like the tumult of an army. When they stood still, they lowered their wings. Then there came a voice from above the expanse over their heads as they stood with lowered wings. Above the expanse over their heads was what looked like a throne of sapphire, and high above on the throne was a figure like that of a man. I saw that from what appeared to be his waist up, he looked like glowing metal, as if full of fire, and that from there down he looked like fire, and brilliant light surrounded him. Like the appearance of a rainbow in the clouds on a rainy day, so was the radiance around him. This was the appearance of the likeness of the glory of the Lord. When I saw it, I fell face down, and I heard the voice of one speaking. He said to me, "Son of man, stand up on your feet, and I will speak to you." As he spoke, the Spirit came into me and raised me to my feet, and I heard him speaking to me. He said, "Son of man, I am sending you to the Israelites, to a rebellious nation that has rebelled against me. They and their fathers have been in revolt against me to this very day. The people to whom I am sending you are obstinate and stubborn. Say to them, this is what the sovereign Lord says. And whether they listen or fail to listen, for they are a rebellious house, they will know that a prophet has been among them. And you, son of man, do not be afraid of them or their words. Do not be afraid, though briars and thorns are all around you, and you live among scorpions. Do not be afraid of what they say or terrified by them, though they are a rebellious house. You must speak my words to them, whether they listen or fail to listen, for they are rebellious. But you, son of man, listen to what I say to you. Do not rebel like that rebellious house. Open your mouth and eat what I give you. Then I looked, and I saw a hand stretched out to me. In it was a scroll, which he unrolled before me. On both sides of it were written words of lament and mourning and woe. And he said to me, son of man, eat what is before you. Eat this scroll. Then go and speak to the house of Israel. So I opened my mouth, and he gave me the scroll to eat. Then he said to me, son of man, eat this scroll I am giving you and fill your stomach with it. So I ate it, and it tasted as sweet as honey in my mouth. He then said to me, son of man, go now to the house of Israel and speak my words to them. You are not being sent to a people of obscure speech and difficult language, but to the house of Israel. Not to many peoples of obscure speech and difficult language whose words you cannot understand. Surely if I had sent you to them, they would have listened to you. But the house of Israel is not willing to listen to you because they are not willing to listen to me. For the whole house of Israel is hardened and obstinate. But I will make you as unyielding and hardened as they are. I will make your forehead like the hardest stone, harder than flint. Do not be afraid of them or terrified by them, though they are a rebellious house. And he said to me, son of man, listen carefully and take to heart all the words I speak to you. Go now to your countrymen in exile and speak to them. Say to them, this is what the sovereign Lord says, whether they listen or fail to listen. Then the Spirit lifted me up, and I heard behind me a loud rumbling sound. May the glory of the Lord be praised in his dwelling place. The sound of the wings of the living creatures brushing against each other, and the sound of the wheels beside them, a loud rumbling sound. The Spirit then lifted me up and took me away, and I went in bitterness and in the anger of my spirit with the strong hand of the Lord upon me. I came to the exiles who lived at Tel Aviv near the Kibar River, and there where they were living, I sat among them for 7 days, overwhelmed. Let's pray. Father in heaven, we are grateful to be in your house today, and we are grateful for your word. And we pray that you would speak it afresh to us this morning. Help us to hear you, to receive you. We pray that you would make us more and more like you. In Jesus' name we ask, amen. Well, Maddie's not here, but I still got to just go ahead and get this one out of the way. So, you had the vision, right? And you have this kind of throne vision, and you have the wheels. And what are the wheels covered with? Eyes. Okay, what is that all about? If Maddie were here, she would get it. God is rolling his eyes at Israel. Just had to get that one out of the way. But kind of kicking myself for not catching it last week. But during the course of the week, you meditate on Scripture and things kind of come to you. So God was rolling his eyes. And you're not moved by it whatsoever. But Maddie would have appreciated that. So you can pass that on to Maddie. Okay. Kind of jumping into it. So we're going to look at context from three angles, really. So the first context, before we get to the focus part of the message, which is going to be on chapter 2 and that first half of 3, the context is kind of threefold. So the first part of the context is we get the date that we are in the fifth year of the exile of King Jehoiakim. And so what that tells us is kind of the time period and the setting and what's going on. And we spent a lot of time on that last week, but let me just say this much. That the situation is exile. That the Babylonians had come And they had surrounded Jerusalem, laid siege to it, and finally the king, his name was Jehoiakim, he hadn't been king long, but he realized that he was in trouble, and the best thing he could do, the only thing he could really do, is surrender. And so he surrendered to the Babylonians, and the Babylonians took him, and they took the educated, they took people with some power, they took priests, they took them captive to Babylon. And they resettled them kind of south of the city of Babylon in this area near the Kibar River, or some of your translations will say the Kibar Canal, and settled them there. And it was kind of a war-torn area, so they were capturing one population and moving them to another part of their empire and having them kind of resettle that part of the empire, kind of redevelop it. And so the date is probably about 593 years before Jesus, somewhere kind of in that time period, 593 BC. And so now in Jerusalem, there's still a king, still part of the line of David. His name is Zedekiah. We're not really going to deal with him today, but I just want you to know he's there. And so we are 5 years into kind of Jehoiakim's exile. But there's still kind of hope, because the city is still standing. They still have their own king, even though he's a vassal king and he's having to pay tribute to the Babylonians. They still have their own king. They still have the temple that's there, the place where they go to worship God and to meet God. And they're still settled in their land. Though while Jehoiakim and a number of them, like Ezekiel, have been taken captive and moved someplace else, they still kind of have that kind of geographical boundary, if you will, or identity in terms of the land. So kind of the common hope was that this was going to be temporary. That because there was still so much in place, that what Ezekiel was experiencing, what those with him were experiencing, Jehoiakim was experiencing, that somehow that was going to be kind of temporary. That they would be able to go back home soon, that this was just kind of a glitch, you know, and God keeping the promises about always having a son of David on the throne, my name will be at the temple, that being the promised land, your land that I've given you. So that's kind of the first part of the context. Okay, the second part of the context has more to do with Ezekiel the man. So we saw that in verse 1, we have this 30th year language. And probably what that's a reference to is that Ezekiel himself is 30 years old. We also saw that Ezekiel was the son of Buzi, a priest. So Ezekiel is a priest, now 30 years old. He was taken captive when he was 25 years old. 30 is kind of a special age. Well, Jose, 30 years old. So Jose and Ezekiel, they're kind of connected today. So 30 years old is kind of a special day in the life of a priest. Because as at 30, that meant that you were now kind of trained, qualified, mature enough, responsible enough. Now you were ready to enter service in the temple. That up till age 30, it was all about preparation. It was all about training. It was all about getting you ready. But now that he's 30, in his 30th year, now he's ready to do what he was trained to do, what he was prepared to do, what he was born to do, to serve in the temple. Okay, now what's the problem? He's nowhere near the temple. That he is in captivity in Babylon. I'm guessing for 5 years he had probably been praying, Lord, just get me out of here and back to Jerusalem so I can serve you in the temple. So that I can do what I was born to do, what I prepared to do, what I trained to do. And those 5 years come and go, and he's 30, and he is still by the Kibar River in Babylon. And he's not going home. A very tragic day, a very unfulfilling day. Context number 3. Chapter 1's vision. So at 30 years old, when he should be going into the temple to begin service, what happens is that God comes to him. God comes to him there far, far from the temple, the Kibar River, and he comes to him in this vision. And we talked last week some aspects of the vision, that it's kind of a storm vision, coming on this storm wind out of the north. We saw the throne aspect of the vision, where he sees one that looks like a man, only he's so bright that he can't really look at him. He just looks fiery, seated on this throne, and this throne is above the sky. And what's holding up the sky? Well, these four creatures. And these four creatures have four faces each, and they have four wings each, and kind of with two wings they're kind of flying and maybe holding up the sky. The other two wings are covering themselves. The four faces, looking straight ahead, the face of a man, to the right, the face of a lion, to the left, the face of an ox, and behind, the face of an eagle. And we talked a little bit about that. We don't know exactly what to do with that, but it just seems like those four faces represent the creatures that have dominion over all the creatures. So the lion, kind of king of the jungle, king of the wild. The ox, kind of the strongest animal on the farm, king of the domesticated. The eagle rules the air. And then you got the face of a man, and humanity was given dominion over all the creatures. And so here you have these four creatures with these four faces that in some way probably represent all creatures. Symbolic of all creation. What are they doing? Well, they are in service to the throne. That God is kind of on this platform, the sky, if you will, much like a dome. And they're kind of holding up the dome. In other words, they are kind of lifting up Yahweh, lifting up God. And we talk about maybe lifting up God on praise. Well, they're kind of lifting up God on the sky. But it's a way of worship. It's a way of acknowledging that God is God. And maybe there's four of them, because the earth was kind of thought of as having four corners. And so now what we have is these four beasts from kind of the four corners of the earth holding up the sky, God's throne that covers all the earth. There's no corner that's not covered by God's throne. And then we add the wheels. And of course, the wheels are covered with eyes, not simply because God is rolling his eyes, but covered with eyes because God is all-knowing and the wisdom of God, and nothing gets past God. And then the thing about wheels is that wheels are mobility, but wheels also keep you connected to the ground, unless you hit a bump really fast. But wheels are kind of the mobility, but also the groundedness. And so this throne that's above is in touch with the ground. And it moves on the ground. And so that there's no place that is kind of beyond the place where God can rule. And so the mobility comes in. And so Ezekiel is realizing that God is not somehow bound to the temple back there in Jerusalem. That God's not confined there. That God is actually able to kind of establish God's rule right where Ezekiel is. In captivity, Kibar River, Babylon. So God has come to him. And that's kind of the vision that he has in chapter 1. And now we're at a place where we're ready to move on a little bit. Well, let me say one more thing about the vision before we actually get to the rest of the text. The vision is not an end in itself. And that's why last Sunday, even though our focus was the vision, I made sure that we read all the way through 3:15. The vision is not an end in itself. It's not just so that he can have a God experience to talk about. The purpose of the vision is his calling to be a prophet. The purpose of the vision is to establish Ezekiel as a prophet and to move him, to empower him to do his work. And I think we have to be careful here, that we don't kind of come out of this in some kind of way seeking the vision. I mean, yes, I know we want to see God. I know we want that. I know we want God's vision for our lives. I guess maybe what I'm trying to get at is that we don't begin to make Ezekiel's vision normative for our experiences. that we don't kind of compare, wow, I must not be very spiritual because I sure haven't seen that. Or that we don't start kind of seeking those kind of experiences or visions as if that's what it's all about. Okay, I don't know if this is connecting or not. We should not be simply seeking God experiences. Relationship with God, yes. But simply God highs, no. You see, I think sometimes what can happen is we can read about a vision or we can hear somebody else's testimony about what they've been through and think, man, that'd be a great experience to have. What a wild vision. What a trip he was on. And we almost begin to kind of seek the experience rather than actually seeking God. We actually begin to seek the high rather than really seeking God. And so that's why I say it's important that we recognize that his vision is really kind of unique. He's the only one who really gets a vision quite like this. And so we shouldn't really use his vision to kind of norm our experiences. And we really shouldn't be a people that is kind of caught up into simply seeking God highs. God experiences like, wow, I need to get an experience. I mean, I don't know. Sometimes even our testimonies degenerate to that. To where we think we're, you know, testifying about God, but what we're really testifying is about, you know, what great experiences I have. The thing that comes to mind, probably shouldn't, but one of the things that comes to mind is just in terms of things like summer camps. And so summer camps oftentimes get evaluated in terms of kind of the God experience. And, you know, how out of this world was that experience? And sometimes when we start comparing churches or whatever, we start comparing along the lines of, you know, how out of this world was the experience? And sometimes even in personal testimonies, we start to go there and it's almost about who can out-experience who. And it gets to the point to where every Sunday or every camp or whatever it might be has to somehow be a higher high than the one before. Kind of a higher experience. And so we've almost reduced God down to just having an experience instead of the one who is actually the Almighty who rules and we serve. So be careful that somehow you don't get deceived into kind of norming our experience, your experience, after this experience that Ezekiel has, after this vision. Now, on the other side of that, though, let me make sure we got this right. That while his experience may not be the norm, the revelation is the norm. And see, that's what we have to make sure that we kind of live our lives towards. Not the experience, but the revelation that Ezekiel and therefore we are receiving through this vision, that God really does reign. That God really is sovereign over all places. That there is no place where his throne doesn't reach into. There's no place that his throne can't get to where his rule cannot be established. And so make sure that we kind of realize, okay, there's revelation that's taking place, and that's what our lives need to be kind of measured by, governed by, rather than simply the experience. Are you seeing the difference kind of between experience and revelation? And I think sometimes we kind of miss the revelation because we get so caught up in experience, but it's the revelation we need to get. Okay, one more thing on this. I know you want to get on. But the other piece of this is that I'm not sure Ezekiel was looking for this. It sounds like it was more God coming to him. Maybe Ezekiel was praying and he was probably hoping he would kind of see God in the temple, but I don't think he was looking for this. And how would we know about this? The only way we would really know about this is if Ezekiel talked about it. And so what would be the things that might get Ezekiel talking about this? And it's interesting that for the first 7 days, he's not able to say a word about this or anything. And I suspect that, again, it's tied to his ministry. That Ezekiel is called upon to do some things that nobody would choose to do. But he's called upon to do some things. And I imagine at some point, somewhere along the way, the question started to come to him, Ezekiel, why are you doing this? Ezekiel, why have you set your life in this direction? And that's when Ezekiel has to testify. That the only reason why I'm doing this is because I was by the Kibar River and it was the fifth year and I had just turned 30. And I had this vision. The vision empowers the life. The life comes out of the vision. And for the things that God called Ezekiel to do, it probably took this kind of vision. Because he is going to have a hard, hard life. Well, let's go on. So he's on his face, and he hears the voice speaking to him. And he gets a call. And so we're looking at 2:1 through 3:15, and there's four chunks to it. So let me identify the chunks, and then we'll talk about them a little bit. So chunk number one is 2:1, and it goes down to about 2:8. And in this kind of first chunk, we have kind of the first, I don't want to call it a conversation because God is the only one talking. But we have the first kind of commissioning where God is telling Ezekiel that I am sending you to the Israelites and they are a rebellious house, but you're going to say to them everything I tell you to say. So that's kind of commissioning number one, 2:1 through 2:8. Then the next chunk is kind of a shorter chunk, but a very important chunk, 2:9 to 3:3. 2:9 to 3:3, and this is kind of, now we shift into a little bit more of a narrative, a little bit less of God speaking some, but the focus here is the scroll. So now he sees a scroll. He doesn't just hear voice, but now he sees this scroll, and God tells him to take it and to eat it. So that's kind of the middle part. Next chunk, 3:4 through 11. This is kind of the second commissioning. Notice how we get a very similar line, Son of Man, go now to the house of Israel, speak my words to them. So we get commissioning, focus on the scroll, commissioning again. What's at the center of the commissioning? The scroll. So the scroll is at the center of this whole thing. And then chunk number 4 begins at verse 12. It's 3:12 through 15. And it's kind of the wrap-up of the end of the vision. And Ezekiel kind of returning, if you will. I mean, he hasn't really gone anywhere. But he's been in this vision. And it's Ezekiel kind of being returned to, you know, everybody else there at the Kibar River. And he is silent for 7 days. Okay, with me now? So we got those four chunks, commission, scroll, commission, and then kind of the return and the end of it all. Now, at the center of it is the scroll. So what we're going to do is we're going to talk about both sides of it first in terms of the commissioning, and then we'll talk about the scroll, and then we'll also talk about kind of the return, so you know where we're going here. First thing that catches our attention is that God calls Ezekiel Son of Man. I mean, did God forget his name? I mean, I could maybe start doing that with some of my students when I can't remember their names. Hey, Son of Man. Hey, Daughter of Woman. But Son of Man, what's up with God calling Ezekiel Son of Man? Well, I think there's two aspects to it. The most common aspect is that God is emphasizing that Ezekiel is simply mortal. And so some of our translations will have, instead of Son of Man, we'll have mortal. or human. So it's kind of this huge contrast between God and human, and it's kind of like God is reminding Ezekiel that he's just a human. I don't know that Ezekiel needed reminding that after this vision, but that might be what's going on, where it's kind of like, you're just a human, don't forget it. I'm kind of leaning a different direction on it, though. Who is Ezekiel? He was a priest, son of Buzi, a priest. And probably if you would have asked Ezekiel, he could have told you who he was, his whole lineage. Lineages were very important to priests. It's how they were able to establish that they really were a priest. So priests would know their family line. And priests would be able to kind of trace back their family line, you know, all the way back to the Levites. And it's how they were able to establish what kind of section of the priesthood they belonged to and what they were, quote-unquote, entitled to do in terms of their service as priest. So priests were very aware of kind of their family line. So like I am Steve, son of Reuben, son of Leslie, son of Jackson. And that's about as far back as I can get. And I'm even not completely sure that Jackson was the name of my dad's granddad, but I think it was. Okay, well, why can't I go back any further than that? Oh, we're just common people. Just common. But if you were a priest, everything was tied to your lineage. And you had to be able to take it back. And what's God calling Ezekiel? Someone who would have known who they were a son of, who they were a son of, who they were a son of. God just says, son of man. It's like, Ezekiel, you're human before you're priest. You got to let that priest stuff go for a little bit. You're simply a man. You're simply human. Not so priestly right now. And what kind of convinces me that maybe that's the right way to begin to understand this is when God refers to the Israelites. Look with me over to verse 3. He said, son of man, and sending you to the Israelites to a rebellious what? Nation. If we were reading in Hebrew, it would say to a rebellious goy. Do you know who the goyim are? The goyim is plural for goy. The goyim are the nations, the Gentiles, all those who are not so chosen, all those countries that are not so holy. And so he says, man, son of man, not son of a priest, but son of man, I'm sending you to the Israelites, that rebellious nation. Normally, Israel is referred to as a people, in particular, God's people. But here, they're just one more goy among the goyim. I'm sending you to that nation that was supposed to be a holy people that is really very, very common. In fact, they are rebellious against me. So what is going on in this opening part? Is that it seems to me that God is kind of revealing to Ezekiel just how common he is and how common Israel is. That a priest was to be set apart. That Israel as a people was to be set apart. But the way they've been living, the way they've been functioning, they are not so set apart. They've actually become common. They've actually become just like everybody else, living in rebellion against God, and maybe even worse. And so God tells Ezekiel, son of man, I'm going to send you to Israel, that nation, not that people. That nation that is rebellious. And rebellious got emphasized a whole bunch of times. And they're kind of obstinate. They're stubborn. One of the images that Ezekiel uses that doesn't always get translated is that they were stiff-headed. So I don't know if you can imagine someone that's just kind of stiff-headed, but I can see somebody that's stiff-headed that just kind of has their head down and they're going to do their own thing and they don't pay attention to what anybody tells them. Just kind of stiff-headed. And God is saying that's how Israel is. That they are so stiff-headed that they don't even listen to me. They're just bound and determined to do what they're going to do. And God says, Ezekiel, son of man, I'm sending you to them. And they won't listen to you. They didn't listen to me. And there, it's going to be tough. But that's who I'm sending you to. Make sure that you listen to me and not to them. The other part of the commission that I wanted to touch on, it's kind of that, chunk number three as I laid it out. Look with me at verse 4. He then said to me, son of man, go now to the house of Israel and speak my words to them. You are not being sent to a people of obscure speech and difficult language, but to the house of Israel. So you're not going to the Babylonians. You're going to the people that should get this word, the language they know, you know. Verse 7. But the house of Israel is not willing to listen to you because they are not willing to listen to me. For the whole house of Israel is hardened and obstinate. But I will make you as unyielding and hardened as they are. I will make your forehead like the hardest stone, harder than flint. God's telling Ezekiel they are a hard-headed bunch, a stiff-headed bunch, but good news for you, I'm going to make your head harder than theirs. That you and Ezekiel's name means God strengthened or God made hard. And so God is going to take Ezekiel and God is going to do some transformative work in his heart, in his life, so that he becomes even more hard-headed, stiff-headed than what Israel is. And they are going to clash and butt heads, but Ezekiel's not backing down. And he will be hard-headed, and he will hold fast to what God tells him. And as they reject Ezekiel, they're rejecting God. And God is almost like telling Ezekiel, get ready for it. Because they rejected me, don't think it's going to be any better for you. But I'm going to make you hard-headed enough for the job. And so go and say my word to them. And so look at the scroll for a moment. Let me read those verses again. It starts at 2:9. Then I looked and I saw a hand stretched out to me, and it was a scroll which he had unrolled before me. On both sides of it were words of lament and mourning and woe. And he said to me, son of man, eat what is before you. Eat this scroll. Then go and speak to the house of Israel. So I opened my mouth and he gave me the scroll to eat. Then he said to me, son of man, eat this scroll that I am giving you and fill your stomach with it. So I ate it, and it tasted as sweet as honey in my mouth. The scroll. And eating the scroll. I think there's probably a few things that we need to look at with it. So maybe the first thing is that he's given a word from God to go proclaim to the people. So he's not supposed to be speaking his own words. He is to be speaking to the people the words that come from God. Don't let your own agenda creep in here. Don't let your own attitude creep in here. But here are the words that you are to speak. And so he really is a messenger. Then he's not supposed to tell the people what they want to hear. He's not supposed to tell the people what's going to make him look good. But he is supposed to tell the people the words that come from God. Okay, so he is a prophet. He is called to be a prophet. But I think there's more to it than simply that he has words for the people that come from God. So notice... Notice about the scroll. What words are on it? Bitterness. Lamentations. Woe. I mean, these are grieving words. These are painful words. And so he's supposed to eat these words. He's supposed to eat this scroll. And he is supposed to go deliver this to his people. I don't think he minded those words as much as he minded who it was for. So it would have been wonderful if God gave him words of woe and lamentation and bitterness, and God told him, okay, go to Babylon and start preaching this to the Babylonians, that God has woe and lamentation and grief coming to you. But that's not who he was sent to. These words of woe and lamentation and bitterness, they're not for the enemies that captured them and transplanted them. It's for the house of Israel. It's for his own people. Instead of getting to go and announce that God's going to pay back the Babylonians for what they've been doing to us and that we'll be going home soon, he gets to go to his own people who are right there with him. And he gets to say, we got to keep crying that there's more woe that's coming. There's more bitterness that's coming. There's more grieving that's coming. That we haven't even begun to see what God is about to pour out upon us. And then he has to eat them. It's interesting that he eats them and they taste sweet as honey. But then did you notice how he left? Verse 14. The Spirit then lifted me up and took me away, and I went in bitterness and in the anger of my spirit with the strong hand of the Lord upon me. I mean, that doesn't exactly sound like somebody who just had something sweet. It looks a little bit more like what we saw in Revelation, where it tasted sweet, but it was kind of sour in the stomach. So Ezekiel eats the scroll, and he becomes what he eats. You are what you eat. And the words become a part of him. The words become a part of his life. He digests the words. He is the words. So no longer does he simply have the message out here external from him. But because he eats it, he internalizes the message. And what was on the scroll? Bitterness, woe, judgment. And so it's no longer simply a message, but he internalizes it. And it becomes a part of him, and he's a part of it, and that's his life. And the strange thing is that it is sweet, but it's also bitterness and anger, but it's sweet. There's nothing that really compares to being right with the Lord. But at the same time, there is a deep grieving that's going on as he is right with the Lord. And so there is a sweetness to it in the midst of the bitterness and the lamentation and the anger and the grief. But he knows it's right, and that's what's sweet about it, as hard as it is. And so he is to go, he becomes the word, and he is to go to the people, and he is to proclaim everything that God has to say. But notice that when he goes to the people, when the vision is kind of over and the Spirit returns him, that he's overwhelmed. And there's anger and bitterness and torment. And he sits among them for 7 days and doesn't say a word. It seems to me that what Ezekiel is experiencing personally is what they're going to experience collectively as the people of God. That he becomes the woeful words, that becomes his life. And he's basically going to live it out in front of and before his fellow exiles as a symbol of what God is doing. And the 7 days, we like to think about seven as kind of a perfect number, a divine number. And so here we have almost kind of this heavenly number, and yet it's 7 days of being overwhelmed, indignant, consternation. 7 days in front of his people. And it's almost like that in itself is a symbol of what's coming. Now, we got to figure out what to do with this. And the short answer is that this is a time of judgment. And that Ezekiel and this scroll embodying the judgment that's coming upon the people. That they thought they were going to be going home soon, and Ezekiel gets this vision and gets this mission and gets this scroll to eat and to embody. And the word is, in short, judgment. Got me thinking. Ezekiel ate the word, digested the word, became the word. Who is the word? Well, yeah, it's the Sunday school answer, Jesus. That in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, and he was with God in the beginning. And then we go on down a little bit further, and the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld his glory. Jesus is the Word. And in Jesus being the Word, one of the things that Jesus does is that he takes upon himself the judgment that God has for all humanity. So as the Word, Jesus goes to the cross. As the Word, Jesus bears our sins. And so I don't know exactly all the Word that, I don't even know if that's a good way to say it. I don't know exactly all the Word that Jesus embodies as the Word. Well, I mean, God, yeah, I get that. But one of the things that we see in Jesus is that he goes to the cross, that he bears. He becomes the sin offering for all humanity. And in a lesser kind of a way, but perhaps in that very kind of a way, that's what's going on with Ezekiel. That Ezekiel has eaten this word. It comes from God. And the word is judgment, and Ezekiel is going to kind of bear the judgment that his people are going to go through. Become a symbol that this is what God is doing through, what God is going to do to them. And eventually we'll see what's going to come out the other side is kind of a recreation, just like comes out the other side of Jesus' death, a resurrection. But that's getting too far ahead of the story. So what if kind of the word that we need to ingest, digest from Ezekiel and the word that's been given him, what if that word is judgment? And what if it's judgment because, like them, we have become all too common? Again, I can't get away from Ezekiel the priest being called Son of Man. And I can't get away from the house of Israel being just another nation when they were chosen to be holy. And they weren't holy. They thought of themselves as being separate and distinct and privileged and holy. But somewhere along the way, they had lost such contact with God that they quit being holy and they started being common. And it grieved God horribly. And I suspect that the priesthood, from what we read in the prophets, what Ezekiel himself will have to say later on, that the priesthood, those who were supposed to be even set apart further among the holy, to be really holy. And he just says, Ezekiel, Son of Man. And I guess why this kind of is striking home to me, at least a little bit, is you may or may not be aware of it, but the Church of the Nazarene is kind of known as a holiness people. That the Church of the Nazarene comes out of a movement within church history back around the 1900s, early 1900s, late 1800s, it was called the Holiness Movement. And we kind of understood ourselves to be a people that were set apart from other churches, other branches of Christianity, to really belong to God and to really be marked by the presence of God and by the Spirit of God, and that maybe even through us, the rest of the church, rest of the churches, could somehow be revived again, and we would all be known as the holy people of God. And the Church of the Nazarene would do things like sending missionaries around the world and to lost peoples. The Church of the Nazarene would do things like, okay, these are the things that make us holy, that set us apart as belonging to God. That we don't go to these places, we don't indulge in these forms of entertainment, we're not going to get wrapped up in jewelry, we're not going to get wrapped up in dress, we are going to be very simple, and you're going to be able to tell that we really do belong to God instead of the world. And the Church of the Nazarene would engage in things like, we get our name the Nazarene because Jesus was from Nazareth. And the thinking was that nothing good could come from Nazareth. And yet there was God at work in Jesus from Nazareth. And so we were going to be the Church of the Nazarene, not simply the Church of Jesus, but Jesus the Nazarene, in order to kind of communicate that we were going to be the church that would be so holy that we would enter into neglected parts of the world, neglected parts of the city, places that were kind of abandoned by everybody else, that we weren't afraid to go there because of the holiness of God would transform those places and those lives. And so when I read this about Ezekiel, son of man, not son of a priest or a priestly line, and Israel, normally the holy people that has just become common, no longer any different from the Babylonians, really, it begins to strike home a little bit. Like, we're supposed to be holy, but how holy are we? And it seems to me that we have become terribly common. And not common in a good way. Not common in a way that we connect with everybody, that we're down to earth, that you know, we're humble. Not common in that kind of way. But common in not being any closer to God. Common in not living any differently. Common in not loving any better. Common in not practicing any more faithfulness or righteousness than those who aren't in the church. And it's not simply that we've become so common that we're just like the rest of the evangelical church, or we've been so common that we're just like mainline denominations, or no, I mean, in some ways we have become so common that we are just like the unchurched world. When you look at how well we love, when you look at how well we reconcile, when you look at how integrated we are, when you look at how we spend our money, when you look at how we spend our time. So, what are we going to do this afternoon? I'm going to the Super Bowl party. You know, it used to be that even in my time as pastor, it used to be that you'd catch whatever you could of the Super Bowl, and then we were coming back for Bible study Sunday night, and you could catch the rest of it if you happened to be able to get it on your VCR, or you would hear about it in the news, read about it in the paper. I mean, that's how uncommon we were. That we really were set apart to God, and we weren't going to let the Super Bowl get in the way of our being separated to God. And then we started to get the idea that, hey, You know, we could watch the Super Bowl and turn it into an evangelism event. And what we'll do is we'll have a Super Bowl party, and we will start inviting our unchurched friends to the Super Bowl party, and then at halftime, you know, or after the game, we will have, you know, Bible study or prayer meeting, and that way we'll show, you know, our unchurched friends that we're really pretty cool, we're not just holy, and that, you know, we'll win them to the Lord that way. And then I've gotten to the point where I just realize I'm going to a Super Bowl party. And I'm not convicting Phil and Kat at all for hosting it, because I'm going, and I'm glad they're hosting it, and they got good TVs. But I read this, and I think about all days today, and I think about, wow, look how common we really have become. And I wonder how God feels about it. I wonder if God is grieving over the church in, say, North America. A church that has become so common that it's very difficult to distinguish the church from the rest of the culture. A church that has become so common that, like the rest of the culture, it never really says anything is wrong. A church that has become so common that, like the rest of the culture, it really doesn't practice reconciliation. That it dresses like the rest of the culture, it acts like the rest of the culture, it holds grudges like the rest of the culture, it misuses money like the rest of the culture, it protects people that shouldn't be protected like the rest of the culture. I mean, I just wonder how grieving, how brokenhearted God is over the church in North America. I doubt God's very excited that we finally become like the rest of the culture so that we can win the culture to Christ. And so Ezekiel is told to eat this, and what Ezekiel is discovering is the grief of God. And it's like he's being sent to his own people to help them know that God is grieving over how common they've become. And until they embrace and repent of kind of where they're really at, then there's not much hope for them, and there's also not much hope for the world. And maybe that's part of what's going on with Jesus. That when Jesus goes to the cross, maybe what he is doing is much like Ezekiel, the scroll that was given to Jesus was to be that atoning sacrifice for the sinfulness of the world. And so that he bears it, the grieving heart of God. And maybe at this point, it's not really wonderful news, and I probably ruined your Super Bowl afternoon. We'll get over it though. But maybe as we come to communion and we take the body and the blood, we shouldn't just think in terms of forgiveness, or we shouldn't just think in terms of the hope of the resurrection. We shouldn't maybe even think in terms of God loved us so much that he gave his son. Maybe as we come to receive that broken body and that shed blood, maybe it ought to fill us with some bitterness and some woe over our lives, over how common we've become. Maybe it ought to fill us with God's broken heart. And maybe when we get to that place, maybe then we'll see revival. That will give us a life that we can't find in the culture. A life that comes only from that throne above. I invite you to stand, and I know we didn't sing this one earlier, but Charlene, could you come and play Just As I Am? And as we sing, I don't know what song number it is in the song book. I know it's there somewhere. But as we sing Just As I Am, I invite you to come and to receive the bread and receive the cup and kind of enter into God's grieving. I invite you to come.